Questions? So we've been looking at the problem of adding angular momentums. It's kind of just the tip of a huge iceberg where you can get lost in all of the possible ways of dealing with these angular momentum operators and in general other Lie algebras. So the problem we've been dealing with is where we have two angular momentums, which I've decided to call L and S just so I have different letters. Not uncommonly, they just be called J1 and J2. And in the particular case we're thinking about, separately they're not conserved, but the total angular momentum is conserved. That is to say, it commutes with a Hamiltonian. And what we want to do then is to build eigenstates of J that are built from the product states of the orbital angular momentum and spin angular momentum. And these coefficients show how to do that. So in general, we have these product states and we're trying to make a particular eigenfunction. And what these tables do is they give us the required coefficients. So if we focus on where we were adding, say, orbital angular momentum 2 to spin 3 halves, we can of course get everything from the sum of those two. So we can go from J being 2 plus 3 halves to the difference. And every integer step in between. And what we have here then are all of these possible values for the total angular momentum, and then the coefficients that are necessary in order to make the corresponding state. So what we've looked at is the particular states that have z component of angular momentum that's minus a half. And for example, we might want to make the 7/2 state. And what this says is that we, of course, only want to combine states that have the right value of total m. So if I take the spin as totally down and the orbital angular momentum is partially up, I have a total angular momentum in the z direction that is minus a half, and it's a candidate state. And so each one of these products work in terms of giving us this value of mj, and so we can build the corresponding state. And then the coefficients we need are square roots always, so we always take the square root of this number. And if it's a negative number, we put the negative sign outside of the square root. So if I wanted to build a state that had a total angular momentum of 5/2, and that angular momentum was oriented partially down, I want to be looking at these coefficients. Right? So what I would be doing then is taking 20 square root of 27/70, and that would be combined with a state that has, of course, everything has orbital angular momentum 2. This thing would have z component that is 1. So this is that YLM. And I want to combine it with a spin state. Everything has spin 3/2. And this one wants to have be fully down. And then I want to add to that the next one, right, which has coefficient that is 3, is that 3 or 5? Looks like 3/35. And then we have the orbital angular momentum being having no z component, and we have the spin being somewhat more up. And so it goes. So not uncommonly, we don't actually need these coefficients, we just know that we could build those states. So we can always build those states for the J values from the difference in angular momentum to the sum of the angular momentum. And of course, for every J, it's going to be 2J plus 1 degenerate, because I can have that total angular momentum have any orientation. Matt?
Where does the 2, 1, and 2, 0 ket come from again?
2, 0, the 2, 0 ket?
Well, either one of them, like where it was part of the...
So everything is 2 in the orbit, and everything is 1 half for the spin. And the fact that it's 0 in the z direction has an m value of 0 came from that. And it's paired with spin that is minus 1 half. And you can see the earlier state, it was 1 and minus 3 halves. And these guys, of course, have to add up to give us the z component that we want. So another kind of global way of thinking about it is if we write down all of the product states. So there I've written down all the product states. I have 2L plus 1 choices for the orbital angular momentum, 2S plus 1 choices for the spin angular momentum, and I've arrayed them all. If I look at this maximal state, I can show that it's an eigenfunction of J squared with an eigenvalue that is equal to L plus S, in this case 2 plus 3 halves. And I know that I can use the lowering operator to find the particular combination of the lowered states that has exactly the same value of J, but now has a Z component that's reduced by 1. But I have 2 states here, and I've only used up 1, so there will be another linear combination that corresponds to 1 lower value of J. So, I don't know, in the end, the dimensionality of a vector space doesn't depend on what you use for its bases. So if I add up all of these states, either in the total or in the product states, I have to get the same number. And in fact, it works. Questions? Good to go? Maybe. Well, we've already broached the subject of having multiple particles, right? The helium atom as opposed to the hydrogen atom. When we talked about having different angular momentums that commuted, for example, the orbital angular momentum of the first electron only depends on the coordinates of the first electron, and it's going to be commute totally with the orbital angular momentum of the second electron. So that's chapter 5, where we start to think of multiple particles. In the end, we're going to want to solve systems where we have, 6 times 10 to the 23rd particles, but let's start smaller and just think about having 2 particles. Well, maybe before we think about 2 particles, we should think about what 191 had to say about this sort of stuff. So back in 191, you proved a theorem that the total kinetic energy, right? So that would be for every particle, add up its mass and its velocity. I could write that total kinetic energy as, we usually call it the kinetic energy of the center of mass. So this is now the total mass. And this velocity of the center of mass uses the usual formula. And then we would have the relative kinetic energy. So we would add up the velocity measured relative to the center of mass. Okay, so a typical classical theorem. You also showed that the total angular momentum similarly breaks up into 2 pieces. So it's pretty clear that the center of mass is going to be an important component in all of this. And, you know, let's see kind of how that works. So if I've got two particles, and I'm just going to be writing x's, but of course it's just as much true for y's and z's. So if I have two particles, then the location of the center of mass, we'll use a capital S for it, it's going to be m1 x1 plus m2 x2 divided by the total mass. And if we kind of think about this generic situation, so what we have is a center of mass that's located where x marks the spot, and here is the center of mass vector that points from the origin to the center of mass. And then we would have these vectors, x1 tilde, x2 tilde, that say where the particles are from that location of the center of mass. If we just have two particles, though, those two vectors have to be equal and opposite directions. So we're better off using the relative coordinate, which is just the difference between those two locations. So this gives us our new coordinates in terms of our original coordinates. It's also helpful to write down the reverse transformation. So if I do that, if I want to calculate the location of x1, notice if I multiply this guy by m2 over m and add them up, I'll cancel that out. So what I'm going to get here is m2 over mx plus the location of the center of mass. Okay, so if we're thinking about a hydrogen atom where we've got a proton and an electron, then almost all of the mass is in the proton. And so to a pretty good approximation, if we write this thing out, then the center of mass is going to be right next to particle 2, and here's particle 1. And x is pretty much then the same as x1, right? The relative location of the particle relative to the center of mass. Okay, so x2, if we work it out, we want to multiply this by m1 over m and then subtract so that that term cancels out. So we get minus m1 over mx plus the location of the center of mass. Okay, and the same thing would work just fine for velocities. Nothing new there. So let's write down what the total kinetic energy is. So the total kinetic energy, that's going to be 1/2 m1 v1 squared plus 1/2 m2 v2 squared. And the velocity of particle 1, just take the time derivative of that equation. So we're going to get m2 over m, the relative velocity, plus the velocity of the center of mass. And we can simplify this guy down. The velocity of the center of mass squared is going to include m1 and m2. So we're going to get the total mass times the velocity of the center of mass squared. In terms of the cross terms, we're going to get m2 times m1 from this term, and we're going to get minus m1 times m2 from that term. So that cross term is going to cancel out. In terms of the relative velocity squared, here we're going to get m1 m2 squared divided by m, and here we're going to get m2 m1 squared divided by m. And we've got lots of consistent terms in here. If we factor out that quantity, we've got m1, m2 divided by m squared, and we're going to have left over m1 plus m2. So we've got m1, m2 divided by m. The product over the sum, and this is a quantity that's called the reduced mass. Usually denoted by mu. And product over the sum, that's like the resistor rule, right? So we can also say that 1 over mu is 1 over m1 plus 1 over m2, right? Same formula. So again, if we're thinking about the hydrogen atom where m2 is most of the mass, it's the proton, then the reduced mass is pretty much the mass of the electron. It'll be a little bit less than the mass of the electron. Okay, so that's how it all works classically. How does it work quantum mechanically? So instead of having vectors like this, we've got Laplacians, right? So what we're going to have for the kinetic energy in our Hamiltonian is going to be minus h bar squared. I might as well pull out the 2. 1 over m1 and then the Laplacian of position 1 plus 1 over m2 and then the Laplacian of position 2. And I don't know, it should work out, you would think, that this would be minus h bar squared, 1 over the total mass, the total center of mass coordinate squared, plus 1 over mu, and then the relative coordinate squared, right? That would be the equivalent decomposition that we saw classically. But it's totally different, right? We've got derivatives as opposed to just vectors. It's kind of not immediately clear how this is going to work out. So, I don't know, let's go at it. So, what is the derivative with respect to, well, I'll put the x's again. What's the derivative with respect to x1? Well, so we have the chain rule. This is the derivative with respect to the center of mass coordinate with respect to x1, the derivative of the center of mass coordinate, plus the derivative of the relative coordinate with respect to x1, derivative of the relative coordinate. So here is x as a function of x1 and x2. So this quantity here is just m1 over m. And here is x as a function of x1. So this quantity here is just 1. So derivative with respect to x is m1 over m, derivative with respect to center of mass, plus the derivative with respect to the relative coordinate. And of course, it works the same way for derivative with respect to the second coordinate. We're going to get the derivative of x with respect to the second coordinate. It's going to give us an m2 over m times the derivative with respect to the center of mass coordinate. And then when we take the derivative of this guy, we're going to get minus the derivative with respect to x. So those are first derivatives. We need to have second derivatives. And since this is just a constant, this is going to work out just exactly like a square, right? And for the Laplacian, yeah, I guess I don't want to do what I just did. Well, because remember, I really have this 1 over m1 and this 1 over m2. Okay. So, plug and chug. So if we look at the cross term, the m1 is going to cancel, and we're going to get a plus sign here, and we're going to get a minus sign there. So the cross terms are going to go away. In terms of the derivatives with respect to center of mass coordinate, we're going to get one of these m1s is going to cancel out when we do the squaring. So we're going to get m1 over m squared plus m2 over m squared. Second term from this term. And for the other term, we're going to get 1 over m1 plus 1 over m2 times the derivative with respect to the relative coordinate squared. And that, we know, is the same as 1 over the relative mass. It's looking good there. And here we have total mass divided by mass squared. It's going to give us the 1 over mass. So the separation for n equals 2 that gives us the relative coordinate and the center of mass coordinate, it works just exactly the same way in quantum mechanics as it works in classical mechanics for kind of totally different reasons. So if we're looking at the hydrogen atom, the full Hamiltonian is going to be minus h bar squared over the total mass, the Laplacian of the center of mass coordinate, and then exactly the same Hamiltonian we've been dealing with, except now we have the reduced mass as opposed to the electron mass, and we're going to have some interaction potential, so it's going to be, say, minus z e squared divided by 4 pi epsilon naught, and then it's the relative coordinate, the separation between the proton and the electron that enters into the potential energy. So this is a case then where the Hamiltonian separates into one piece that just depends on one coordinate and another piece that just depends on the other coordinate. And we know that under these circumstances, the full wave function is just the wave function for the first Hamiltonian times the wave function for the second Hamiltonian. And we have solved the problem for the second Hamiltonian. That's the hydrogen atom problem, right? So these things are the things that we've called R. It's going to depend on the relative coordinate, and we're going to have YLMs of the orientation of the relative coordinate. The second Hamiltonian is a free particle. So that also has easy eigenfunctions, right? E to the I total k dotted into total x with corresponding energy. That's h bar squared k squared divided by 2m. Okay, so that's a moving hydrogen atom. The center of mass is moving with some momentum, that total momentum that is h bar capital K, and we have a relative energy that in dimensionless units is minus a half 1 over the principal quantum number squared. Okay. Well, the two-particle problem classically is fine. Newton said that the three-particle problem made his headache. It's kind of a mess to deal with classically. These center of mass coordinates are not all independent. They have to add up to zero as vectors because the location of the center of mass relative to the center of mass is zero. And having coordinates with constraints is kind of a mess. So both classically and quantum mechanically, lots of particles is not a happy problem. And we're going to have to deal with that with some sort of approximation methods, which is kind of the topic of the chapter that follows. The one case that's relatively easy is if there's no interaction. If there's no interaction between these particles, then the Hamiltonian can be written as the sum of Hamiltonians for each particle, and the corresponding wave function then is going to be a wave function for each particle that depends on the coordinates of that particle, the product of all of those guys, and the total energy is just going to be the sum of the energies of each one of those states. Okay, so if we're thinking about something like the helium atom, we know that the two electrons are going to have a repulsive force, just as there's an attractive force between the Earth and Jupiter, but if you subtracted Jupiter, it's not going to make an immediate change in how the Earth responds. It's still going to continue on with its mostly Keplerian orbit. So the interactions are in some sense small between Jupiter and the Earth. They definitely exist long term. They definitely change the orbit of the Earth. But we ought to be able to treat them as a perturbation. And as I say, that's all the topic of the next chapter. So it sounds like we're done with this chapter. There's n particles, there's the solution. It's all sounding good. And I guess it is good if you have the Earth and Jupiter as your two particles. But typically when we have multiple particles, we have multiple identical particles. And that's going to open up a more difficult set of problems. So if we make a helium atom that consists of a muon and an electron, we're all set. Those are two distinct particles. Everything I've said will apply just fine to one of these muonic atoms. But most helium consists of two electrons, and those two electrons are indistinguishable, absolutely indistinguishable. And since they're absolutely indistinguishable, the wave function really shouldn't depend on what state is particle one in, because you couldn't tell what state particle one is. The two are absolutely independent. The wave function really has to depend on the occupancy. What states are occupied by one of those electrons, and what states are unoccupied by that electron. So it has to be dependent just on the occupancy, not on which electron is where. Okay, so from a product wave function, I could say that particle 1 is in a 1s state and particle 2 is in a 2s state. But that can't be a wave function because particle 1 and particle 2 seem to be distinct, but they're identical. I can't tell the difference between particle 1 and particle 2. They're identical electrons. Again, if one was a muon and one was an electron, this is a perfectly good wave function. But for identical particles, we have to treat them identically in terms of quantum mechanics. So we have to have a wave function that just depends on what are the occupied states and what are the unoccupied states. So another way of kind of getting at this is if we have identical particles, if we make an operator that exchanges, for example, particle 1 and particle 2, and we call that operator P for permuting, then it must be that the Hamiltonian will commute with the permutation operator. And it's no big deal to see how that would work. So the Hamiltonian is going to be 1 over the mass, and then the momentum of particle 1 plus the momentum of particle 2. And if we're talking about this for a nucleus, then we have minus z e squared 4 pi epsilon naught 1 over r1, and the other electron also interacts with the nucleus with 1 over r2, and they also have an interaction plus E squared divided by 4 pi epsilon naught 1 over R1, R2 vector, the distance between the two electrons. And obviously, if I take 1 and I swap it with 2, I get exactly the same Hamiltonian. Right? So the permutation operator commutes with the Hamiltonian. And what that means is that the wave function has to be an eigenfunction of the permutation operator. Now, usually it's been a big job to figure out what the eigenfunctions are of operators, but for the permutation operator, it's simple because the permutation operator squared is to do nothing. So the eigenvalues of the permutation operator squared have to be 1. And so there are only two eigenvalues, right? Plus 1 and minus 1. We can have things that are symmetric under exchange, or we can have things that are anti-symmetric under exchange. The only two possibilities. So I can make something that is symmetric by taking a symmetric combination of these wave functions. Right? And I can do the same thing with a minus sign, and I can make a wave function that is anti-symmetric. Okay, so we could specify the wave functions according to their symmetry under particle exchange, and the wave functions, because the permutation operator commutes with a Hamiltonian, the wave functions have to have a definite value for the eigenvalue of the permutation operator. Well, now comes the kind of surprising statement. It's called the spin statistics theorem. And it's not an easy theorem to prove. You prove it in the context of relativity. And so there is discussion about whether relativity is a required piece, if you could change the universe so that relativity was not true, would the spin statistics theorem still be true? In some sense, it doesn't matter, right? Because relativity is true, but it's an interesting, I guess, theological question. And also people are looking for proofs that have the minimum number of assumptions, just like mathematicians do. But the well-known proofs of the spin statistics theorem are in the context of relativity. So it's beyond the topics of this course, so we're not going to prove the spin statistics theorem. But what the spin statistics theorem says is that turns out there are two possibilities. That either the wave function is overall anti-symmetric with respect to exchange of any two particles, and so far it didn't need to be that way, right? So you could imagine, for example, a wave function that was symmetric with respect to exchange of 1 and 2, but anti-symmetric with respect to exchange of 2 and 3, right? That would satisfy the requirement that they have a definite eigenvalue. But instead, for identical particles, they either have to choose plus 1 or minus 1. We have no mixed symmetries. And the choice of whether you have anti-symmetric under exchange or symmetric under exchange is determined by the spin. So the so-called half integer spins okay, so that's a word that kind of doesn't really make sense, but I hope it's obvious. What I'm talking about is spin 1 half, 3 halves, 5 halves. Those things all satisfy the condition that the wave function has to be anti-symmetric under exchange. And the so-called integer spins That is to say 0, 1, 2, they all satisfy those rules. So particularly because half integer spin, you know, doesn't make sense, right? One is half of two. It's nice to have an additional name, and we've got lots of dead physicists. So half integer spins are called fermions, and integer spins are called bosons. Bose was a famous Indian physicist, worked with Einstein. And Fermi, Italian physicist who had Jewish connections, so he came over here during the war and ended his life at the University of Chicago. Died of cancer, probably as a result from working on the bomb. I don't know, so examples, probably most of the particles you know and love are spin one half, right? Electrons, protons, neutrons, quarks, all of those things are spin one half. In terms of spin, in bosons, right? Nobel Prize for Higgs, it's a spin zero particle. The alpha particle, the helium nucleus, it's also spin zero. But you know, there are larger, there's no reason that you have to have smallish numbers, although the ones that have biggish numbers are not as famous. Three halves, a standard example is the delta particle that I mentioned before. Someplace I bothered to look up some bigger numbered examples, typically nuclei. So the oxygen 17 nucleus is five halves. Oh, and the deuterium nucleus is spin one. You can get pretty big spins, 3, 4, 5 sort of spins out of nuclei. And I guess some elementary particles also have some pretty big spins. There are special cases of bosons called the gauge bosons. So light is spin one in a special sense. Gluons, the things that hold the quarks together in protons and neutrons, those are also spin one. The graviton, it will never be discovered in your lifetime, but there's good reason to suspect that it's spin two. So spin is a characteristic that can be written down in tables. Majority of things that you know and love are spin one half, but particularly composite particles can have higher values of spin. So one of the things that's maybe worth commenting about the gauge bosons is if light is spin one, there should be three versions of light, right? There should be spin up light, spin sideways light, and spin down light. And it turns out because it's a gauge boson, the spin sideways light doesn't exist. So we have right-hand circularly polarized light and left-hand circularly polarized light that correspond to the spin up and spin down, but there is no transversely polarized light, except under special circumstances, when it's not a gauge boson. Okay, so there's an extra requirement that these wave functions be fully, for atoms, be fully anti-symmetric under exchange, and that makes it more difficult to find allowable sorts of wave functions. And it leads to sort of situations that the handout is describing. But the first thing to maybe think about is that I've been writing so far the wave function as if the spatial part was the only part, right? But there's spin too. So I can, for example, make a fully anti-symmetric wave function by putting both electrons in the same state, but then put them in an anti-symmetric spin state. So if I exchange the so this is exactly the same function, the 1s wave function. If I exchange the coordinates there, it has no effect. But if I exchange 1 and 2 here, I get a sign difference. So it's then kind of a matter of mixing and matching these wave functions in order to get something that is totally symmetric or totally anti-symmetric. So this is going to be the ground state of helium. In terms of the spatial wave function, put them both in the lowest available state and put them in spin matching states. You might remember that this thing here has total spin zero. And things that have spin zero are usually called S. But we've already used S for the orbital angular momentum. So instead of labeling the spin with a letter, we're going to label it with the degeneracy, right? So in general, there's 2s plus 1 states. S is 0, so this is called a singlet state. We can make a triplet state. We can make three different triplet states, right? We could have doubly spin up, doubly spin down, or 1 over the square root of the symmetric combination. Right? All of these guys have spin 1. So these things are going to be called triplet states. A single electron by itself can be spin up or it can be spin down, so those are doublet states. Okay, so in order to make things difficult, we have letters and words in order to describe the corresponding states. And those things are summarized on that handout, which I guess I can't display anymore. Right, so here you have all of the letters of the alphabet that go with orbital angular momentum and all of the singlet doublet words that go with the spin. Okay, so how about the excited states of helium? Right, so if I put one of these electrons into an excited state, that's not an allowed state, right? Because it's not going to be symmetric or anti-symmetric when I exchange 1 and 2. So I better either take a symmetric or an anti-symmetric combination of them. And then I compare it. If I use a symmetric combination for the spatial state, I can pair it with an anti-symmetric spin state. Or if I take an anti-symmetric spatial state, I can pair it with a symmetric spin state. Which one has the lowest energy? Right, so this is the ground state. I've just mentioned two other states. Which one has lower energy than the other? So what we're talking about now is the interactions of these two electrons, right? Because absent interactions, these things would be degenerate. But we really have interactions, but we don't quite have the technology to talk about interactions, which I said is going to be some sort of perturbation theory. But as a good guideline, until we get there, I think we can judge what state is going to have the lowest energy by looking at the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. Now in terms, so we wrote down a moment ago all of the terms in our Hamiltonian, but up to here, all of those terms give the same value for these two states. It's the interaction state, it's this term here, that's going to govern the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. So can you do that integral in your head to figure out which one of these states is going to produce the lowest average value of this quantity? Well, you can with a little bit of practice. So, in order to get a positive contribution to energy, to push a state up, we're going to have those electrons have to be in the same position, right? If the electrons are separated by a great distance, then this term is going to be small. If the electrons aren't separated by a great distance, then we're going to have a positive contribution to energy. So the question is, which one of these states keeps these electrons as far apart as possible? If they're far apart, it's going to be the low energy state. And the one thing that I hope you can see for sure is that the value of this wave function, when R1 equals R2, so if I ask what's the probability of the electrons being on top of each other, it's zero for the antisymmetric state. Whereas it's going to be bigger than average for the symmetric state. So the antisymmetric spatial state is going to have lower energy than the symmetric state. Okay, so if we start to draw an energy level diagram for helium, here's our ground state where we have both electrons in the 1s state. If we have one electron in the 1s state and one electron in the 2s state, we're going to have two states, right? We're going to have a triplet state and we're going to have a singlet state. And we've said that the triplet state is going to have lower energy than the singlet state because the triplet state makes it impossible for the electrons to be on top of each other. Well, how about for the 1s, 2p? Now, if we neglect the interaction term, the 2p and the 2s have exactly the same energy, right? It just depends on the principal quantum number. But we actually have some sort of interaction between these guys. So we can think about that 2p electron as interacting with the nucleus and the charge cloud of the 1s electron. Okay, so picture big positive nucleus. Here's the cloud of the other electron. What's going to be the energy difference between the p state and the s state? So classically, what do these two orbits look like? Well, remember the s state, it's the state that has the lowest possible angular momentum. Whereas the p state has the same diameter, right? The semi-major axis determines the energy. It is the same diameter, but it's circular as opposed to being elongated. So the 2p state is really not going to experience a Z equals 2 nucleus. It's mostly going to experience a net charge that is just 1. And since the energy goes like the charge on the nucleus squared, in dimensioned quantities, minus 13.6 EV times Z squared divided by N squared, so the 2p is going to see less, is going to see a smaller value of Z, and since it, and so isn't going to have as negative an energy as the 1s state. Okay, so the 1s state, it sounds like a contradiction. It is both on average closer to the nucleus and further from the nucleus than the 2p state is. It goes to greater distances and it plunges to shorter distances in contrast to the 2p state. So as a matter of fact, these 2p states are going to be above the 2s states. And the same argument we talked about is going to work for it. We expect then that the triplet state is going to have a lower energy than the singlet state of these 2p states. Okay, so what I just gave you is a generic argument. If we think about the spectrum of a hydrogen atom, so we have a non-degenerate ground state, we've got two states with n equals 2, we've got three states with n equals 3, four states. These n equals 4 states, S, P, D, F, those four states are all going to be degenerate in the absence of perturbation. But if we think about perturbation, the S state is going to be plunging close to the nucleus. It's going to be experiencing bigger nuclear charges. So these states, which are degenerate in our current approximation, are going to end up tilted like that. So we call this phenomena L tilting. And it's due to the fact that these electrons are interacting with the whole cloud of the other electrons. And you can do this sort of calculation in what's called the self-consistent model, where you assume some wave functions to start with, calculate where the charge is, calculate what the electric potential will be given those charges, and now recalculate your wave functions for this new potential and iterate that process until you get convergence, until the wave functions don't change much. So this was a process done by Hartree, you know, circa 1930, I think. And you remember that Hartree is the name we use for our unit of energy. This was fancied up by Falk. So the best way of doing this is Hartree-Falk these days, where we have self-consistent calculations for atomic energy levels, nuclear energy levels, anytime we have particles that are interacting with a cloud of other particles. Okay, so we'll come back to all of this next time.